From RunAsRadio.com, you're listening to Run As Radio, the internet audio talk show for IT professionals with Richard Campbell. This is Brandon Nguyen announcing show number 641, Cosmos DB with guest Mark Brown. Recorded Tuesday, May 7th, 2019. Run As Radio is produced each week by Sound Thoughts LLC. For more information, go to soundthoughtsllc.com. You can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/runasradio.
Thank you, Brandon. This is Richard Campbell coming to you from the Build Conference in Seattle. It's Run As Radio. I'm talking to my friend Mark Brown, who's the Principal Program Manager for the Azure Cosmos DB Database. Yeah. Hello, sir. First time on Run As. You know, we're a regular over on .NET Rocks.
Yeah.
But you've changed roles the past year?
Yeah. August, I went from, I was on Azure Networking for, about 3 years, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And then in late August, I joined the Cosmos DB team. And then
Cosmos DB is still very network centric, though. I mean, a lot of its magic comes from the way networking
works. Well, it is a distributed database, right? And we're ring zero, so we're in every single region. In fact, you cannot stand up a region without us being there because so many services rely on us and take a dependency on Cosmos.
I think this is a piece that a lot of people don't realize is that Microsoft consumes Azure extensively.
Like absolutely.
You know, Cosmos is dependencies that your own products, your SaaS products have.
Everything is, I mean, all the Ring Zero services are essentially foundational for everything else. I mean, so higher level services run on compute. So they're consuming compute. They run on and require storage.
Can we talk about what Microsoft services use Cosmos DB? Is it Office 365 stuff?
There's a lot of services using us. Skype is using us, by the way, or I guess it's Skype.
Yeah, they keep changing the names.
Yeah, whatever they're called today.
Yeah.
We just did a three-part, blog series about all of the stuff they did, to help enable or run on, Cosmos. And, this is what we find, just like with customers, is Skype is global. It needs to be everywhere. And they need a way to replicate their data, whether it's chats or profiles or anything, all their data, all their telemetry globally, and be able to access it.
We make fun of Skype a lot because it's easy. But, I mean, the reality is I have Skype on every device. When you call my Skype account, like, stuff rings all over the room.
Right. It's like a cascading nightmare of rings.
Stop. But more importantly, like exactly what you're describing, you're typing a chat message to me in Skype on my laptop, and it's on my phone already, and it's on every other device instantly. Like, and it's not like it hopped from machine to machine in my office. That's a round trip into the cloud and back again quick enough that it's virtually instantaneous.
Yep. Yeah, very little lag time. I mean, that's another key feature is the low latency. And why, it's one of the reasons why you would replicate data in the first place is you need to get it as close as possible to the user.
Yeah.
To keep the round trip time for their request into the service
absolutely
as low as
minimal.
Possible. Yeah.
And yet not want to do voodoo like inter-device communication. I mean, it just makes sense to make sure the cloud is the source of truth.
That's correct.
Is it a migration path, or is this a green field kind of product, Cosmos?
You know, it's a lot of, it's both.
Yeah.
Actually, we see a lot of customers who want to, take advantage of the cloud and what it provides in terms of its global scale, and availability and all the other goodness that comes from cloud. And they want to build a modern application and use a modern database that's designed essentially to work for the cloud, right? I mean, this Cosmos as a product or as a service was designed in Azure.
It wouldn't work anywhere. This is not your on-prem database.
It is not.
Right.
And, and so we see a lot of the new greenfield, scenarios, as well as we see a lot of, existing customers with, existing either on-prem or even in the cloud workloads that are using, a relational store.
Sure.
And they want to take advantage of some unique aspects of Cosmos, which is the fact that, single click replication. So if I want to replicate to a new region, I can just add it in the portal, single button click, and boom, now I'm replicating to any of the 54 today, I guess, or even more regions.
Yeah. By the time this is published, I'm sure it'll be a larger number still.
It'll always be.
In excess of 50 at this point.
It's a lot.
Of course, it costs you for every node location you add.
Sure, because there's compute involved with replicating that data. And then essentially every piece of data or every store, every partition has got compute in front of it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So, yeah.
Now, what have I got to do on the front end piece to connect to that local Cosmos repository? Like, do I need to know where these different stores are?
Sure. Functionally, your app is nearly identical. I mean, the only thing that's going to change is going to be a string that says what is the current location for the data store you're talking to.
Okay.
If you're using our multi-master, we have this multi-homing API we call. And essentially what it is you just, in the connection policy, set current location. And then you can choose from an enum or just put a string in there that identifies the region that your front end is deployed in.
Okay.
And then it'll talk to that local instance within the region for Cosmos. The nice thing there is if you're deployed in multiple regions and using Multimaster and you've set that current location and that region becomes unavailable, our SDK client will automatically fail you over to your next closest region.
Next nearest.
Yeah. And so, in fact, this is how we provide an RTO of zero for customers that are using Multimaster. And it's, I mean, certainly one of the biggest selling points is not only do you get low write latency for every region you're deployed in,
mm-hmm.
But you get that RTO of zero in there because we'll automatically redirect you or that region or that app to the next region.
You just don't lose it. You just keep going.
That's right.
The only sign of any problems is it's slightly slower.
That's right. You're going to get now the latency
of however further away the next data center went.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is probably no more than double-digit milliseconds.
Yeah, a lot of customers tend to run kind of region pairs for their applications.
Right.
So they try to keep them geographically close.
Yeah.
And then for customers that are truly global and need a presence in Asia and they need a presence in Europe and a presence in the Americas or a presence in MIA or even in Africa, you can run region pairs there or they can just fail over to that other, whatever that next closest region in.
Right.
You maybe get 50, 60, 70, 100 millisecond.
Yeah.
Until it comes back, so.
Well, it's only a couple hundred milliseconds across most oceans, so.
Yeah.
If you can keep it under 100, you've done something right.
Yeah.
But more importantly, it's transparent to the code, right? The app just keeps working.
It just keeps working. Yeah. So we'll detect like a 500 or something that comes back out in the client and then just say.
Eh. Recover.
Yeah. Just retry it and retry it in the next region.
Right. Interesting.
Yeah.
It's sort of a ongoing stuff. Now, but it's not a traditional, this is more of a key value store. Like, what do you actually describe the storage part of Cosmos DB as?
Right. So, horizontally scalable database, right? So, we're not a relational store. We don't enforce schema.
Right.
You can, of course, imply a schema via the object model that you're then serializing and then persisting into Cosmos or reading back out and hydrating back in. It provides a lot of benefits. I mean, changing your object model or changing your app in such a way that you want to version stuff is challenging in a relational world where you have to define fields and change your indexes and all that other stuff.
Well, and update all clients simultaneously, essentially.
Right. We have lots of customers who run essentially multiple versions of the same app and they just have just different code and they both persist. We'll happily ingest that and index it. And then when they read it back out, they're getting the data they want or expect out of that. So, that makes it just that flexibility is just something that's just much harder to achieve in a relational world.
Sure. But now, you know, the joke, of course, is that relational was always built into analytics. The fact that we cared about transactional velocity is almost like a mistake of marketing. That's where we
the TPCC.
Yeah, all that sort of stuff. Yeah. Like, it became easier to sell the performance of relational databases that it did. It's like, this is for querying.
Right.
But I remember in the good old days where I literally was building a transactionally optimized relational database that then replicated to a querying optimized database.
Yeah, that's the well-worn cow path, isn't it, for that pattern? I did the same back in the late 90s when I was doing high-volume e-commerce, and we were using a relational store. It's basically our operational store for all of that data getting ingested in there. And then, of course, downstream would push that into other systems for doing the analytics.
Well, they became super hard to justify a relational store on the transactional side. Because in the end, all you're actually doing is asking the customer to wait while you decompose the data into rows and columns.
Right.
Just store what you got.
Just
let the guy go.
Right.
And now you can go decompose asynchronously.
That's correct. And in fact, the way we're designed is we're write optimized. So we don't put a lock on anything while you're doing stuff.
Right.
Just ingest it, blast it at us. Right. So instead of inserting an order header and some order details and multiple inserts or whatever.
Right.
Just blast the entire thing as a single request.
Sure.
And then we'll happily store all that.
So you have this journal mindset of, I'm not updating anything. I'm just adding rows.
Correct.
Right.
That's and in fact, you use the word journal. So one feature that we've got that not enough people know about is this thing called change feed.
Hmm.
And essentially what that does, it's like a pub sub within Cosmos. Any write operation that occurs, so an insert or an update, fires this change feed, and then you could subscribe to it using Azure Functions, where we've got a built-in binding in there, and say, oh, new order in there, let me go run some code, or I can, essentially the idea here is that it enables event-driven microservices.
Right.
So I'll go back to e-commerce.
This is your decomposition engine now.
That's correct.
You take the blob, you get it written in, the customer's on its way in content.
Yep.
You know, you can start your e-commerce flow, but completely orthogonal, sitting over here is the flow that goes, okay, now we're going to start pulling this apart and adding it into our analytics store.
Right. Right. So you think, I just push purchase on there. You know, a minute later, I'm going to get an email. Mm-hmm. Well, that email was run from a microservice that went and did a bunch of stuff and then sent you an email, said, yeah, your stuff's there. And then you get another email later, hey, your stuff shipped.
Right.
Right. These are all kind of events.
All these asynchronous events.
Sure.
As things go through the workflow.
Doing an auth on your credit card, another microservice, that's all driven. It's all event driven. Right.
And it also could be after the fact and have a recovery mode. Hey, this card didn't clear. We're not going to cancel your order, but if you can't, you know, we'll cancel your order in 24 hours. You can come back and correct it.
Correct.
And then you can restart the workflow.
Right. It's all your state management in there as well. Right. You can help and control. So,
but it's also not tying anything up and it's not making them wait. It's all async.
Yep.
So it actually means it's resource efficient for me. As an IT guy who's caring about, you know, what are we holding up?
Right. You know, another thing we see it too, and you talk about the analytics, is we see people use this change feed to create what we call a materialized view of that data.
Hmm.
So let's say you have a scoreboard, right? And then you keep getting ingested, like say in a game or something like that, some kind of game actions, and you get more charms or power or levels or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And then you can have a scoreboard, which is basically a materialized view of every player in there.
Mm-hmm.
And then it just does an update, like add the score and then update it. So you have a hot scoreboard and you can do a dashboard on top of that. Right. So, and that's just change feed into another container or another collection.
And I think the latency in this is also measured in milliseconds.
Yep.
So it's async, but it's just not that far behind.
Mm-mm.
It's just arguably it's more expensive to maintain state across all those different kinds of calls to make it synchronous.
Sure.
Like it's not buying you anything.
That would be insane doing that today, right?
It would be.
Yeah. Wait 10 seconds while we
do all these other things.
Yeah. I mean, that's kind of how it used to be, remember?
It is. Yeah.
You know, like you'd push the purchase button and it'd say, please don't refresh the browser.
Yeah.
Right? That's exactly what's going on is we're synchronously processing all this stuff.
As opposed to just, boom, data saved.
That's it.
You're good. Thanks very much.
That's right. If we need something, we'll let you know.
Yeah. We've got many emails coming to you. Mm-hmm. Don't worry. Right? You've got a little time now. But yeah, much more modern thinking. And I could do that on-prem. It's expensive.
Right.
And it's hard to do at scale.
That's right.
And you end up owning a whole bunch of plumbing you didn't want to own.
And right. And we're managed. So you design your model. You provision your throughput. Obviously test and measure, make sure everything is tuned up and working efficiently, and then you're done.
And it's transactionally reliable. Does ACID still mean something in this world?
You know, there's two kind of definitions for consistency, I'll say, within this world. Yes, we do provide transactional consistency.
Mm-hmm.
Within a stored procedure, you can have a transaction in there that'll be an all or nothing.
Yep.
Within
that. It all completes or it all rolls back.
Correct. So we provide the ACID definition of consistency.
Mm-hmm.
In a distributed database world, though, we also have another definition for consistency, and that is the uniformity of data that's spread out hundreds or thousands of miles.
And with multiple write locations.
Correct, right? So we need to maintain consistency at that level, right? So that's kind of the CAP theorem version of consistency, which is if you're working in a distributed system or a distributed database, CAP theorem is something you care about, right? Mm-hmm. Which is, and for your listeners who don't know, CAP was something proposed, I think, in the late 90s.
Yeah. Been around for a long time.
Been around for a long time. And, you know, and what it said is, you can't get more than two out of the following three things, which is consistency, which is your data is going to be consistent across large regions.
Right.
Or availability, which is, I'm going to get back a response, even a non-error response, and it may not be the latest data,
mm-hmm.
possibly, or partition tolerance. And that is, my distributed system is going to work even if the network is cut between them, right? You can't do all three of those things.
Pick two,
and that's it. Mm-hmm. So,
but eventual consistency, I think, is accepted in the world today, and I would argue because of Facebook.
Yeah.
Because Facebook did a distributed database very early on. I'm sure they did it the hard way, but everybody learned if you made a post into Facebook and immediately went back to your feed to look at it, it wouldn't be there.
That's
so
right.
Then you'd post it again and then two would show up.
That's right.
And so you're pretty quick figured out. It's like, it's eventual consistency.
That's right.
Give it a minute.
That's right. I think they're finally getting it.
Yeah, I think the average person now has a sense that it's like, give it a minute. It's going to space.
There's a lot of workloads. I have this conversation frequently. Mm-hmm. Is I must have strong consistency.
Absolute
in my applications.
Yeah.
And I tell them, and this is, by the way, the addendum to CapTherm is PackLC, which is mm-hmm. essentially CapTherm on the front end.
Right.
But even if your network is working, you still have to choose between consistency and latency.
Right.
So if I want a strong, consistent, distributed data store, I'm going to pay for it in latency. I cannot have low latency. And why is because if I do a write anywhere in that distributed database, I have to commit it to every replica before I can act back to the user. If
right.
that replica is 1,000 miles away, mm-hmm. there's a couple hundred milliseconds
sure.
of latency right
so you're
there.
Making them wait.
And this is exactly the synchronous part of it. It's
yeah.
serialized versus if I do a relaxed level of consistency. Well, I can act back right away because all I need is just a local. I need a local quorum.
Right.
Right.
And I have enough information to proceed.
That's right. I've got your data. Right. I will take care of replicating this and getting it eventually
yeah.
or consistent in some fashion.
Most people, I see, they're real fearful around the consistency part. What they're actually afraid of is not an inconsistency, but an invisible failure.
Yeah.
So the main thing is just having failures visible.
Right.
At least know there was a problem here and they could have a chance to do something about it.
I think, you know, how I try to make this real for people is I start with what is your RPO
mm-hmm.
for your application? If you truly need RPO zero, then yes, maybe you should use strong consistency.
Sure.
However, you need to understand the implications of which will be, you know, a hit to your latency.
Right.
Versus if you need an RTO of zero, then you don't need, you know, you can't do the strong consistency
yeah,
kind
it's
of.
Not, it's not essential.
That's correct.
And it's incredibly expensive.
Right.
And Mark, give me one moment here for this very important message.
Okay.
Your app stores data in SQL Server, but your queries aren't as fast as you'd like. Your users are getting frustrated, and you're wondering, is there maybe a database problem? Could I make this whole thing go faster without changing the queries? Brent Ozar can show you how with scripts, online training classes, and hands-on help. Get a free health check today at brentozar.com.
And we're back. It's Richard Campbell here at Build. It's Run As Radio. I'm talking to my friend Mark Brown. We're talking about Cosmos DB and actually really more the philosophy of this modern distributed data stores, which, you know, propagated bit by bit. And one of the biggest resistances to all of this was that it was too hard to build. The fact that I don't have to build it anymore, that it's literally a knob I set in my Azure console, kind of takes the air out of all of those problems. Am I still using typical database connectors? Like, how do people attach their apps to Cosmos DB?
All right. So we have an SDK client that mm-hmm. people can use. There's multiple ways. So you can use our SDKs.
Yep.
We have one for .NET. In fact, we have a new one coming out, built in .NET standard that will work for core.
Mm-hmm.
Should go GA here pretty soon. And then we have also a Java async
right.
SDK.
So it's pretty agnostic. It's just typical with Azure stuff.
Yeah, and then a JavaScript one or a Node one, and then a Python library. You can go against our REST API mm-hmm. if you decide. So
you had a MongoDB implementation almost right away as well.
Well, so we support MongoDB at a Wire protocol level.
Okay.
We don't create a Mongo client,
no.
but customers can use the standard Mongo clients.
Point being, I have an existing Mongo app, and I could switch to Cosmos DB without changing my database implementation.
Yeah, generally, you should be able just to use...
switch the connections, right?
Yeah.
It's kind of cool when you think about it.
Mm-hmm. We don't have new clients, but we have new API support. So, we announced support for Spark API.
Right.
So, this is...
Which is kind of crazy.
Fascinating. So, here's what you can do is you can provision... say a SQL API or a SQL account,
mm-hmm.
And then additionally add Spark API support on top of that. And now what this lets you do is you can now run Spark analytics right on top of your operational data.
Hmm.
No need to go spin up a bunch of Spark clusters and ship all your data over there and then run your Spark queries there. You can do
so
it right.
So this is an analytics side to Cosmos DB that I can now, instead of what I used to do, which was set up a Spark cluster and do the analytics separate from my data store, I'm just running Spark against
Spark. Correct.
That's magic.
It is.
It's just time saver.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know if it's going to be a money saver because Cosmos DB still charges me for consumption.
I think it would be a money saver too.
Because you're not standing up that spark cluster.
Right. And you're not managing it.
Right. Well, that's a brain space thing.
Right. Yeah.
Mentally, it's things you need to think about.
Yeah.
I mean, back when I was hardware constrained, I used to do stuff like you'd take the test lab and flip it over to be a Hadoop cluster and do some analytics on it over the weekend and then flip it back to being the test cluster. Mm-hmm. God, we did magic stuff, you know, back when you cared about hardware. But
you know what else we've got is notebook support. Not just for Spark, but across all of our APIs.
The Azure notebooks.
Jupyter notebooks.
Jupyter notebooks.
Yeah, and built right into our Cosmos Data Explorer. Mm-hmm. So I think it's actually beautiful. It's lovely to look at and run in there. So that's all out in preview right now. And then we also announced preview for our etcd support. So this is the data store behind Kubernetes. Mm-hmm. And the idea here is to build or to provide customers a way to have a globally distributed Kubernetes store basically behind their deployment, so you can essentially offload all of the hard work or manageability and get 5 nines of availability out of that.
So I immediately start thinking about next level CDN thinking. Mm-hmm. Where as demand goes up at a particular location, I'm literally lighting up localized instances of an application.
Yeah.
And then could probably automate just tearing it down again.
The other thing, too, is the bigger you scale, the bigger your masternode has to be. But
right.
When you offload all this into Cosmos, you don't need to do that, mm-hmm. right? So you don't have to get insanely expensive on having a big masternode because you've got a massive global deployment of Kubernetes out there. So. Right.
Yeah. I'm not ready to think about all of that. Because suddenly you're thinking in terms of instances of machines, like whole container sets. Mm-hmm. And orchestration around that, like dynamically, globally allocating out software. That's spooky.
Yeah.
Like, and there's only certain problems that's going to fall into, but for the right organization, that's a huge deal.
Yeah. We wouldn't have built it if customers weren't saying, I need a way to.
I poked around on User Voice. I got to tell you, I'm doing my research. Right? Mm-hmm. I'm going to have a conversation. And I looked through User Voice, and the top items are all demands for more features. Mm-hmm. That to me says a successful product. The people are using it enough that what they only want from your product is more.
That's a great thing, isn't it?
It's really interesting.
I actually manage our User Voice.
Okay.
So I'm the guy writing all the responses on there.
They seem reasonably civil. I mean, User Voice can get ugly.
Yeah. You know, it has its moments.
But am I wrong? Like, am I missing is there an item here that's been like the bugbear that's hovering there?
Oh, I don't know. Hard to say. I mean, yeah. There's ones in there. What I can say is there are some in there. That have been in there for quite a while, and these are now done. We've shipped this.
Right.
So, like, skip and take was one that's been in there for quite a while.
Yeah, it's right at the top.
We now support skip take within Cosmos. So, I'm going to, after this week, I'm going to go in there and point people to our docs and say, this is now complete.
Nice.
And mark that as done.
We just announced that build, so you didn't want to take it out of User Voice until it was done?
You know what? I think we're going to make a more formal announcement around this next week.
Oh, okay.
Just wanted to stay away from the din of all the noise that happens during build. So, some of these things we want to make sure people were aware of.
Sure.
Rather than getting buried. So, we're deferring some of the announcements of the stuff. We've got the docs for this stuff is up already.
Fantastic.
Yeah. And then things like Distinct. There's a lot of requests in there. But you know what's great? And one of the reasons I love working on this team mm-hmm. is the pace that we work at. It's just amazing. They're just knocking off things in User Voice.
Well, because you're not waiting for a DVD ship every 18 months. Right?
That's right.
You deploy that feature almost immediately.
When it's ready.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you've tested it sufficiently. Well, and I can see, again, like I'm poking through User Voice, and I'll include a link because it's great to look at. So you do say things like, there's work on this feature now happening. It's not shipped or anything, right? But we'll let you know when it's going to be ready. What do you think of this? Like, need feedback.
Right.
Tell us about this implementation.
And that's, I'm always asking for feedback. If I'm not quite clear on what the scenario is that's driving that, I will ask, we want to make sure we understand what people are looking for.
I'm sure there was at least one where I said it seemed to me like they'd gotten to a certain stage of development and needed to make a choice mm-hmm. and just pushed it back to voice. Saying, okay, we've gotten this far. let's get opinions on how, what we want to do with this long term.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of these. So I've marked a bunch of these in here as started.
Yeah.
This stuff is all coming really close. We get a few of them in here that are really questions how do I put this? They don't quite understand the non-relational world. So
right.
When they're
I saw one in here about transactional behavior, and it's like, I think you don't quite grasp what this product is.
Right. Like
you're asking it to do something it's not supposed to.
Like a cross container transaction or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's not,
it's getting out of realms.
Right. Everything centers around the partition, right? We're horizontally scalable, right? It shards out your data by partition.
Right.
So, that's where we provide the transactional, context for you is within partition.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Or the partition key.
Safer bet. Always a challenge as soon as I get out of SQL land is the querying methodologies.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, SQL's got its problems, but there's such a pool of knowledge around getting data out of from via SQL.
Well, it's been there for decades.
Yeah.
Right. And not only that, but also people who create the engines for these databases have also gotten pretty innovative as well in terms of how they optimize the queries and being able to make sure those are well performing.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually far more straightforward in a non-relational world, in a horizontally scalable database world. It's the trick is how do I model my data? Right.
Right.
And here is the crux where it comes down to is, in a relational world, you're optimizing around storage,
right?
This is why you normalize the heck out of your data.
Back when that was important.
Because storage was expensive.
Yes.
Right? That's not true anymore. Storage is cheap, right? And in this world, you are optimizing around the request,
right?
Which means I do not want to make multiple requests to go get my data.
Mm-hmm.
I want to do it in one shot. So doing things that seem unusual for a relational database developer, which is putting different entities inside the single container,
right,
and then using a single partition key to define how I'm going to partition that data, right? So the order e-commerce example, I'm going to put orders and order details as different items or different records inside the same the same container, and then I'm going to say, go get me order ID 100, and then I'm going to get back the header and then all the details for that.
And the customer information, likely, all of that stuff.
All of it, right? And you can embed that all within arrays inside those documents or inside those records.
I had a very great discussion with an enterprise architect. We were talking about this storage aspect of this thing. And he's like, no, I need the entire order stored as an atomic unit with the customer's information and so forth, because they had been through a legal proceeding involving changing addresses.
Hmm.
And in a relational database where you tend to keep the current address of the customer, then you go query an order from 5 years ago before they'd moved, and the relational database just doesn't handle that well.
Yeah.
Now you need this complex structure about keeping track of when they moved, and you know, it's like, actually what I need is a copy of the truth. The truth is, at the moment that they placed that order, this was the address and these were the things that they ordered. And this is the price that we charged them.
They basically needed like an op log.
Yeah.
Essentially, so they could replay it or go back and look at it.
And again, we only cared about consolidating that information because we're trying to save disk space.
Yeah, right.
And the legal exposure around this was so great. It's like, I don't care how much hard drives cost. I really, really don't.
Mm-hmm.
I need a copy of the truth forever. And these blobs, this chunk of data, was actually the truth. And you could derive everything else from that. And you may or may not do analysis on it. You always go and decompose it and do other things with it. But just having that journal, I think it's a really important way for us as data professionals to think that I want to copy the journal first, and then we'll do all the other stuff from there.
Yeah, and it's useful for other reasons. Sometimes you need to replay data.
Yeah.
Right?
You could actually replay the workload.
Absolutely. So,
and it's not a piece of voodoo. It's just we normally keep copies of the workload.
Right. You know what else about relational that I think was funny? I was working with a customer a few months ago, and they had a system. It was about 10 years old. And you know, very normalized at a certain level there. It's probably about 100 tables in this thing.
Right.
And then what they also had were a bunch of fact tables where they were denormalizing the data because they were staging it up because it was taking too long to hydrate their user interface.
Query performance, yeah.
That's correct. Yeah. So they ended up with this just explosion where they had their normalized data, and then all fact tables or all product tables where they were flattening it out.
Lovely.
And then I said, we're going to do away with all of that and then designed for them a single, basically it was a solution or a model with a single container, put all of their different entity types in there, no fact tables or product tables going in there, and then another container with all of their basically transaction.
Well, when you recognize that the blobs, the objects were the first order store, which they weren't storing,
mm-hmm.
they made a second order store out of the rows and columns, and then they made a third order store out of these fact tables.
Correct.
Right? You just like, why don't we stay with a first?
And just be done with it right there,
be done
right?
With it there.
Right? Because the latency, once you're in, you do an in-partition query, it's going to be super fast, right? Yeah. I mean, we guarantee less than 10 millisecond response time. Right. So what more do you need? And oftentimes at, you know, at 50 percentile, you can get 2, 3, 4, or 5 millisecond, right?
Yeah.
It's going to be half that. So generally pretty good for an application with that kind of response and much simpler.
Yeah.
Right. To maintain.
That's the crazy part. It's also a simpler piece of code.
Right.
Because you weren't jumping through all those unnecessary hoops.
Right.
You just actually tear it all the way down. We've got this dogma trapped in our head around relational stores, I'm afraid.
This is the problem. This is the friction and where I spend the most amount of time, or we as a group,
you're working with customers.
Yes. And helping them understand the concepts behind this and how to successfully model their relational data or any data to work in this sort of data store.
Yeah. And I think it's really interesting. And the more experienced they are, arguably, the more trouble they're going to have.
Yeah. Right? Well, that's yes. So
the conversation we've had on .NET Rocks is all of this wisdom, all of this experience actually scar tissue holding me back?
You have to
think about new ways.
Yeah. What's funny is I have watched the face of some guys that have been like 30-year DBAs and just look at just their foreheads kind of wrinkle up when I'm trying to explain to them what I'm going to do to their model. And they could just, and they shake their head a little bit.
This
and,
can't be right.
Yeah, that's right. I could just see that they're at some point going to explode. But then when I walk them through it and then show them the queries and then the performance on it, they're like, oh my God, I can't believe that works.
Yeah.
It's just, and then I think once they see it,
if you're willing to believe the data in front of you, right?
Yeah. Helping them visualize how data is partitioned.
Yes.
And then accessing it. Helps them, right? Like, what a metaphor I use is just think if you have like 5 apartment buildings, right? Mm-hmm. And you got 100 units in each of them, and you're trying to find a single person. And, you know, the inefficient way of doing it is just to send a single query and then just go search through all 5 apartment buildings. Yeah. That takes forever, and that's a lot of compute and a lot of effort. If you tell me which building I'm in, I can go and narrow that down much quicker. It's a much faster response, more efficient, right? So, because they don't.
But also, you're not living in the locking and blocking world anyway, because everything's a journal entry. It's all fixed data. So anybody can read it that they want.
Correct.
So you can have this huge amount of, you know, again, we get back to the cloud power, which is how much compute we'd like.
Yep.
You've got another thread. You've got another resource available that can walk that, what is effectively read only data to get your results for you.
Right.
So again, these constraints we've forgotten we had, but created dogma for how we do things about number of simultaneous queries and locking strategies and so forth that just make us behave a particular way. They aren't relevant in this model.
They're not. And that's what hasn't kept up is as storage has gotten cheaper and compute more expensive relative to each other, that's where this model of data storage came from.
Yeah.
And where kind of people's minds have not kept up. In that
it's really sense. Interesting.
Right.
It must be fun. I mean, you and I were both old veterans. We've done this a lot. And I don't think we've done too much waxing poetic today anyway. But it's fun to be on the edge of this stuff and be excited.
I've had more fun working on this team than I've had in a really long time.
It's really cool.
I love it. There's a lot of great computer science behind this work. This is still an evolving area.
Sure.
By the way, there's lots of research and papers and
and
hardcore computer science work going on. And on building distributed data stores, it's still not done. There's still a lot of work going on. One fascinating area is conflict-free data types, resolution data types, CRDTs. And this is something we're working on adding support for. But it's and I'll write some blog posts and we'll do lots of education around this. But it's mind-bending. The computer science behind how do you create a data type or a data store that does not have conflicts in its data.
It just doesn't work that way.
Consider the scenario that I've seen is just two people working on a document online, like a Google Docs or something like that, right? And somebody writes something and then somebody deletes something that something just got written or whatever. So you've got all these conflicts. How do you resolve those types of things going on in there? That's what CRDTs are kind of designed, or just a classic use case scenario around that. But that happens in people's data too, in databases. So anyway, it's just it's fascinating. There's no perfect answer for some of these things.
But it is interesting to think in terms of there's new computing science research going on. It's pretty largely because of the cloud.
Mm-hmm.
The cloud has introduced new ways of things, and it's allowing the scientists to press against the edges. And we as, you know, arguably engineers, maybe I'm being a bit generous, are just trying to figure out how to implement it.
Sure.
And take advantage of these great things. Mark, always fun to talk to you. Thanks so much for coming out to spend some time with me here.
You bet. Build. Thank you, Richard.
And we'll talk to you next time on Run As Radio.